Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. So much going on in the media world these days. So many questions, like this one. KCUR broke the Maryville rape story, and yet it didn't make national headlines until the Star ran its story on the case. How come? Here's one more question. Is it okay for news organizations to pay for sources for information? To pay sources for information, how does it affect the quality of the information you get? When the big questions loom, we bring in our media critics to sort it all out for us. They are Peggy Lowe. She's a reporter and editor for Harvest Public Media and a former print reporter. Peggy, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Derek Donovan is the ombudsman for the Kansas City Star. Derek, how are you?
Good.
Pam Fine holds the Knight Chair for News, Leadership, and Community, and is a professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Pam, nice to have you back. Good morning.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the Maryville rape story. Peggy, you're one of the two lead reporters on that story. Your piece ran in July. The Star story ran in October. What's your sense of what happened here and why it took a story in the newspaper to make the big splash?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've looked back on it quite a bit, and I think a couple things happened. First of all, from what our web editor, Brianna O'Higgins, has found, the Star placed that story on Reddit. And then Gawker picked it up from there, and Gawker just ran with it. And, you know, really, I wouldn't say they wrote it in a salacious manner, but it became, you know, a very big thing on a slow news Sunday. And then Anonymous, the hacktivist on the internet, took up the cause and started a Twitter hashtag, Justice for Daisy, referring to the alleged victim.
Right. And so it was social media, in your view, that really propelled this story.
Absolutely.
Derek, what's your sense?
I think that that's very much what happened. I think also part of it is the KCUR story started a snowball in a lot of ways. And I had heard from various people over the past several months who are saying, hey, the Star needs to get on this story in my capacity talking to readers. And I think that it's just something that there was a growing awareness about. And then having another hit there with Reddit and Gawker, and I think Jezebel, actually Gawker's sister site, harder than Gawker even did, really was sort of the critical shove over the cliff.
And truth be told, the Star had been on the story before KCUR ran with it, right?
That's, as I understand, I'm not part of the reporting process, so I'm speaking third hand there, but I think that it certainly had been on the radar.
Yeah. Pam, are there any takeaways from a story, a situation like this where I think it was 2 or 3 months passed, actually. 3 months?
That's right.
Almost 3 months to the day, did my calculating correctly. What's the takeaway from something like this? You know, a radio story versus a newspaper story. The newspaper story seemed to be the one that struck gold.
Yeah, I think it does speak to the power of the printed word to some degree. I went back and looked at the packaging of the radio story, and it started out typically public radio way as a great storytelling, very effective, but it doesn't have the kind of impact that a lead headline on a Sunday front page that says, you know, Marysville nightmare has. And I think the sustaining value of that text and the ability for it to be disseminated easily and then to be commented on really helps.
It's a print product that has some lasting value. Radio, that you hear the voice and it's gone, and that's it in many cases.
Yes.
Right?
I tell students all the time that radio is a more passive accessed media, that, you know, you have to pay attention when you're reading a newspaper. Lots of times we're listening to radio in the car, we're thinking about something else, and we're heading somewhere, and we just don't – it's not like sitting down in your easy chair with the paper.
So what you're saying, that people listening to you right now might be thinking of something else instead of listening to Pam Fine
closely
and carefully?
I hope not.
Could it be? Peggy? Yeah.
I think, too, to Pam's point about packaging, our story went pretty much just, you know, she said this, the cops and the prosecutor say that, and we just kind of went that way and just focused on the alleged rape. The Star story was, I'm not going to say skewed as a sort of advocate, but they basically said, you know, it was sort of the angle was the girl has been done wrong and her family's been run out of town. Oh, and they burned her house down. you know, and that's how the story started.
Well,
I think that was part of it too.
Yeah, the other thing is the Star story went hard after the issue of whether the prosecutor was telling the truth about whether the witnesses would testify. And I think that raised the level of interest in it and also concerns by citizens and others that he may not have been telling the truth. I mean, it really did raise that. Sure. But the good news is that there's a healthy news ecosystem in the community, and that often newspapers are trailing other media, good media, who do stories first and then come back. And of course, vice versa. So the good news is that ultimately the public is getting good information because there's a healthy news system in the city.
Yeah, I want to go back to the original story that KCUR did, though, because this was a fairly unusual story in the sense that, Peggy, you and the reporters on this piece named the victim, named one of the victims. You had photographs of the victim, one of the victims. And this was a fairly unusual deal. You named her, you quoted her, you talked to her mother. And I'm just wondering, given all of that and the two-day run that story had very prominently on KCUR, why wasn't that enough to kick this story into the blogosphere on its own?
You are so asking the wrong person. I mean, when we ran this, so to be fair here, an intern here at KCUR, fresh out of college, Monica Sandreski, got this tip, and she chased it and chased it and chased it. And I helped her. You know, she was a little green, so we got it together. And I told her, I remember telling her, I'm old, and I've been through this a lot. We're going to get all this attention afterwards. Hold on to your hat. We're going to get a million calls. And we really didn't. And so we were very, very surprised. Every morning she'd come to my desk and say, "What have you heard?" And I said, "Nothing." So it was very surprising.
I'd like to jump in. I think the balanced approach that is terrific generally to take back to the packaging hurt the focus or mitigated the focus on whether this girl was treated fairly, whether her case should have had more attention by the prosecutor's office. So I just feel the storytelling approach is great, but it has a wind up that if you're not paying attention, you miss the hit the over the head aspect that I think the print piece had, particularly with its headline.
I still wonder, Peggy, why didn't NPR pick up this story and run with it? Because that would have given, this piece the attention that it perhaps merited, and that didn't happen.
I would agree with you. And, I think where you can
Do you know the answer? Why didn't NPR pick it up?
I don't know the answer other than this. We offered it to both Here and Now, which is, the afternoon show, and to our bureau chief here in the Midwest, and they both turned it down. I think for a couple of reasons. It's complicated. It takes a lot more than 4 minutes to tell that story. It seems like maybe just another rape story in a small town. So they passed it over. Now, when this story went national, it hit the fan here at KCUR, and we really had to hustle up stories. A story I did was on All Things Considered. They're still interested in the story. We ran the woman's, Daisy Coleman's photo. So they made up for it later, but it was much too late.
Derek, when the Star ran the story, this story has had incredible legs on the Star website, getting more hits than any piece we've had in the newspaper going back a ways, right? This has been an enormous driver of attention and interest by lots of readers out there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's one that, curiously, I have heard very little negative feedback about from readers.
That's
too
interesting.
Yeah, and
about the story itself and how it was handled by the newspaper.
Correct. Yeah. And the questions of, naming the alleged victim and these things that we really wring our hands about journalistically, I've heard just, I don't want to say crickets, but very little about it. And I think it's because, for one thing, as the KCUR story made very clear too, the whole reason she was named is because she and the mother were both very strongly saying we want to get her story out there. And so they were actually naming her herself. And everybody in Maryville knew who this girl was, both the girls, from the get-go. So you weren't really letting the cat out of the bag there. But, yeah, the feedback has kind of surprised me. But, you know, that's one thing I always have come to know in this job is that I can never predict what I'm going to hear. People always tell me, oh, you know, your phone's going to be ringing off the hook about that, and I don't hear a thing. And the small things are the ones that take off sometimes.
The decision to name her Peggy in the piece and to run a photograph of her on the KCUR website, how tough of a call was that for the station?
I don't think it was that tough of a call because they wanted to be out there. I mean, it didn't even strike them as something they would consider hiding. Daisy and her mother, Melinda Coleman, were both very open. We want justice. We want attention on this story. And so I don't even think they really – I wouldn't say they didn't think twice, but they were just very confident and really wanted to be public.
And, Pam, that might be a sign of sort of changing values within society that some women, in a way, are willing to come forward. You know, I think we talked before, you know, back in the 1980s, the Des Moines Register wins a Pulitzer Prize for doing a big, long story on one rape in Des Moines. And that woman was named, and that became a national sensation at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think in this case, too, the Daisy blogged about her situation so that she was actually putting out her own story on the web.
Which may have complicated the prosecution on some level.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, if you read the stories and read everything else. Well, this last question to wrap this up. Did you find, you know, all of this, you know, Peggy, were you discouraged by the lack of attention to the KCUR story or the relative lack of attention given what the Star story did? Or how did you feel about it?
I wasn't discouraged. I would say I'm perplexed. You know, I'm new to public media. I've just been here 2 years. And I'm used to having that A1 front page story on a Sunday and all hell breaking loose after that. So I was very confused that it didn't happen. That said, I'm thrilled that it's happening now. I still think it's a really great story.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to some breaking news and this tendency for the media to get it wrong in many cases involving major news events such as the Boston Marathon bombings or the LAX shooting. If not, most of the early reports turned out to be wrong or inaccurate. Derek, how important is it these days to be first rather than correct? I mean, what's going on out there in the media that the media is sort of botching a lot of these big stories just as they're breaking?
This is a place where I may fall out of step with a lot of my colleagues, and I'm willing to go out on a limb here, but I really think that breaking news first is something journalists care far more about than the readership, than the listenership, than the audience does.
These days particularly because of the internet, right?
Correct. Yeah. You know, it's the everybody is breaking all news on Twitter these days, and not just when the Star has a story that they're going to put on Twitter, but also somebody who hears it on the radio is going to tweet it, you know, to some random individual who has nothing to do with journalism. It becomes one of those arguments about, you know, the Red Sea where everybody's fighting and versus the Blue Sea, which is the thing that nobody else is doing and you're kind of specializing in. Everybody is participating in Twitter. You look like you're out of step if you do not participate in it as well. But I don't really think that being first on everything is of the utmost importance to readers. They would much rather you take a little bit of time and figure out what's really going on here. And even if you're not concerned about having to be the first about something, part of the problem with this emphasis on breaking news as it happens is that you don't have the luxury that we've all had in the print media of reflection and figuring out the proportion that this news really should take. Because that's one of the great things about the old world is when you had, let's say, something that looked like it was a spectacular car crash early in the day. It turns out that it wasn't really as big a deal as it looked like. And you can say, okay, that's going to go on page 6. But in today's world, you're going to go and you're going to tweet about that a lot. You might send a reporter to the scene and she might come up with 15 tweets about it until she figures out, oh, wait, you know, that's paint. So, I think that it can really lead you to make some decisions you might regret from a news judgment standpoint later on.
You know, Pam Fine from the University of Kansas, it used to be not so many years ago that getting a scoop sort of meant that you owned that story for a news cycle. You know, your paper hit in the morning, no one else had it, and you sort of had it for a while. But these days, you break a story on the internet, on Twitter, and everybody else just sort of picks it up right away, and it's the value of a scoop has just diminished dramatically, it seems to me.
It depends. Derek and I were talking about this before the broadcast, and I said I still think in some areas, particularly sports, getting that scoop really matters, and that, you know, the goal is to get it first and get it right. And I think that's still a good goal to have.
Well, in sports, it's more important to get it first. Why? What are you talking about?
Well, I just think that the brand is important, and it is that we've got the most feet on the street. We know what's going on. If you want to keep up with what's happening, come to us. And us, in this case, the newspaper. But whoever, I mean, there's a lot of competition in the market, and people want to be the one to own the story. And owning often means breaking the story and then following it effectively.
I'm just making up a story here. Just again, this is fabricating something completely, but Governor Jay Nixon just resigned, you know, and you tweet that. Well, everyone in the world is on that story immediately. So getting it first, Peggy, just doesn't seem to me to matter much at all anymore, because everyone's going to chase that story, that fabricated idea there, and run it down and have big stories on it as follow-ups and everything else.
Well, then clearly we're going to have to kick you out of the journalist club. Because I agree. I mean, I think that journalists care a lot more about when those scoops happen, and the public doesn't as much. But because I know that most newsrooms, though, I mean, and I'll speak for myself, I was psychotically competitive. It's ridiculous.
Oh, and that's the way I was, too.
Yeah.
The way
and
I am.
So, I mean, I just think to some people it's still really, really important. It's about their own credibility, their own brand.
It is. But it's also, I mean, there's a balance. And, of course, getting it right is more important than getting it first. But you want to have a healthy metabolism in a newsroom, and you want your reporting staff to be aggressive and to try to find things out that people don't know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you want some competitive spirit there, but you don't want to go overboard, and you don't want to waste your resources. If everybody's got a story, then let's come underneath it with something we can add value to.
And those are all really great points. And one of the other things everybody needs to remember, too, is that social media, and in particular Twitter, is a medium of shame in a lot of ways. And when you get something wrong in a tweet, that is what
you
people really remember. Mm-hmm. You know, people. There are all sorts of people out there who are ready to take screenshots of any errant tweet from any major media organization to be able to retweet it as many times as they can, throw it back up in your face.
You know, let me just brag about the last time I had a killer scoop. Just a great, great story. And I owned it for a cycle, even in this modern era of the internet. Congressman Dennis Moore told me on a Sunday night that he was going to announce that he wasn't going to run again for reelection. It was a big, big deal. You know, he'd been around for 12 years, and he was stepping down from his seat in Congress. He told me that on a Sunday evening. He was about to put out a press release to the entire world. And I said, you know, Congressman, why don't you hold off on the press release? Let me run with it. Let me have a story here. And he hemmed and hawed, and he finally gave it to me. But I got it like at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. I didn't tweet it right away. I thought, we're going to own this story. I put it out in the morning. The paper had it first in the morning when the paper hit the streets, and everybody picked it up from there. But it seems to me that's the only way to own a story anymore, on a slow Sunday evening cycle when nothing else in the world is going on, Derek.
Yeah, because had you gotten it out there as soon as you'd had it, then, of course, he would have been deluged with everybody in the world wanting to get comment from him. And so, right, what you've done there is you had your own little personal embargo on it.
But the question is that the right way to go? Because it's news. And did I have an obligation to tweet it? I mean, it seems to me if I tweet it at 8 o'clock at night, my paper doesn't hit until 6 in the morning on people's doorsteps. I tweet it at 8 o'clock at night, every TV station and radio station is going to have it before my paper does.
Right, right.
That used to drive me absolutely nuts. Yeah, I didn't want that to happen.
And I mean, that's one of those weird places where journalists kind of become marketers also, because there is a certain – I don't think there's anything necessarily shameful about wanting, if it is a scoop for your organization, wanting to own it a little bit longer like that.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't go up on the internet, Steve?
It did after the 10 o'clock news. I think it would have hit at 10:30 or 11, which the paper intentionally does to sort of avoid
Absolutely.
Having TV stations just rip and read our stuff, you know. So I beat him.
I think it was strategic. But, you know, I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. We're talking with our media critics, Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media and KCUR, Derek Donovan, the ombudsman for the Kansas City Star, and KU journalism professor Pam Fine. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. If you want to chime in on something we've talked about or a question about the media, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at @kcuruptodate. Okay, media organizations getting it wrong. A couple of major news organizations have had to eat crow over big mistakes the past few weeks. 60 Minutes is still in the midst of a problem with its report on Benghazi, with critics saying the apology that the show aired wasn't nearly as strong as it should have been. Then the Associated Press wound up firing a reporter and a pair of editors who inaccurately linked a gubernatorial candidate to court documents. In the case of the AP, the wire service fired a 28-year-old reporter with supposedly an unblemished record over the mistake, which involved assuming that a set of initials referred to a candidate for governor when those initials did not refer to that candidate for governor. Pam Fine, was that a little harsh to fire that reporter over that mistake, or maybe not?
Well,
and there, but for the grace of God,
yeah,
so many times.
You know, I don't know, and I wasn't in the discussions about his history, but he absolutely abrogated the responsibility to check that out. Would you get a document from a source, and in this case, it appeared to come from the opposition campaign? You have got to, first of all, verify that the primary information is correct. And then secondly, give, in this case, Terry McAuliffe the opportunity to comment so that you get the other side, or you get his side of his involvement
Did
in this.
Did they not give McAuliffe a chance to respond
no,
to that story?
No, that was it. They didn't check with anybody. They just took this document and ran with it. It was 114 words, an AP brief saying that Terry McAuliffe, the candidate for governor in Virginia, was being investigated for lying to a federal investigator in a an estate planning case. And it wasn't, turned out to be somebody else with the initials TM.
It was a terrific mistake. But boy, I felt sorry for that 28-year-old AP reporter who, again, at least based on the stories you read, had a great record of being a reporter.
Well, that reporter certainly learned the dangers of listening to what research from an opposition candidate it tries to float in the media. Because, as you well know in your career, Steve, you know there are people out there who work on campaigns who are floating all sorts of things to see what journalists might bite on it. And I think that in this day and age, we see it's even more important for people that are professional journalists to run these things to ground and to really redouble their verification, because there's all sorts of folks out there who will run with this on, you know, particularly when you're talking about somebody who's blogging or somebody who, you know, quote unquote, follows politics, but is really just relaying the talking points from the candidate they like.
You know, how many times have I woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning and thinking about a story I'm working on and thinking, God, did I ask that question the right way? And, you know, you just, again, I read these stories and think, man, in the heat of a moment and getting a story done, mistakes sometimes get made, Peggy.
It's the stuff that keeps you up at night.
Boy,
I feel for this guy. So he was a 28-year veteran of AP.
Of course.
Usually these statehouse reporters for the AP, and I've known a lot of them, are crackerjack.
Terrific.
And I'm not suggesting he isn't. All I've heard was great about him. I would say AP did overreact a bit on that. I mean, so, you know, lay him off for a time, or, you know, do some sort of disciplinary action, but outright firing of him.
Well, they not only fired him, they fired two editors up the line.
Mm-hmm. Who
handled
that
surprising
story.
Yeah. I mean, he should obviously be disciplined, obviously.
And the question just needs to be answered. Why on earth did you not go to McAuliffe and ask about it? That to me is such a fundamental basic that, I mean, in some way heads had to roll, but, you know, I certainly wasn't on the inside.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Derek, what is the fact-checking procedure at, you know, the Star or Peggy at KCUR when it comes to, you know, stories like this, when it comes to breaking news, you're trying to pop up on social media. Sort of what should happen in cases like that?
Well, it's the first thing you said is you have to reach out for comment when you're going to be publishing something like that, you know, because that quick call would have been, just it would have been knocked down immediately, saying, mm-hmm. "Hey, hold on, never even heard of this. You've got mistaken identity," and that should have been something that would have been caught long before.
Yeah.
And it makes me think that reporter had a good trusted source, and that's why he went with it.
Exactly.
And maybe that source just burned him.
Exactly, and the source could have made a good faith mistake as well. You never know. Calling it a good faith mistake, I'm not really sure, but right. You do always have to sort of weigh where the information is coming from, and anytime something seems too good to be true, you have somebody else who's unrelated to it check it out for you.
Well, isn't that the truth? That whole notion of too good to be true, I mean, you just learn as a journalist, rarely, if ever, are stories too good to be true, too clean. There's always, you know, competing interests, complicating factors.
And as
things.
One of my first editors said, if your mother tells you that she loves you, check it out.
Yes. Isn't that the truth?
Come on.
What a great line. That's from Journalism 101, I think. Let's go to some phone calls here for our media critics this morning. Lisa from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, I'm cracking up over that last line about checking out when your mother says,
and that's taught in 101, Lisa. Yeah.
Yes, and as a former reporter long ago, I haven't worked in a newsroom for 20 years or so and have been on the PR side ever since. And I love this conversation because it makes me sad to see kind of the demise of the good old-fashioned reporters like fact-checking, those sorts of things, because I just know in this era, like you were talking about, with social media, there's such a rush. But that wasn't exactly why I was calling. I was curious just to get the input of the way reporters are gathering their information now. I think amongst the PR community, everyone likes to tell themselves that reporters are constantly scouring the web and looking for tweets and anything of interest that these maybe corporations or organizations are putting out in an effort to promote themselves. And I sort of wonder, is that really the truth? Or how could reporters today ever have time to do that and keep up with their story of the day, and not to mention all the social media requirements?
Boy, you're hitting really close to home with those questions, Lisa. Derek, do you want to take a shot at that?
Well, that's such an insightful question to pose because mm-hmm. there is so much information that everybody volunteers themselves these days. And if you are, say, a reporter who is covering, you know, let's say Hallmark, one of the major companies here in town. If you're following Hallmark, you obviously have to look at what all of their press releases are so you can stay atop of, you know, what their business initiatives are. But there's a lot of information out there that journalists have always had access to that moves well beyond what corporations and individuals release in press statements or what you can find freely on Google. You know, there is a wealth of information that companies such as LexisNexis, InfoUSA, and a bunch of others have always made available to journalists, and they can avail themselves of those things that just aren't available on the open web. And that can help you take a deeper dive into a lot of that data. And by the way, these are things that people can get at their public libraries as well. But a lot of folks have really been lulled into this idea that, well, if Google can't find it, it doesn't exist. And that's just really incorrect.
I wonder if I can just speak out on behalf of the home team just for a moment, Lisa. So just, you know, my experience over so many years in journalism that the journalists I've worked with over the years, and I'm really, you may not buy this, but they work so hard to get stories right. And there's so much fact checking, both on the reporting level, the editors asking questions about the stories you write, particularly the ones that are more complicated, more involved. Lots of involvement from editors making sure that any one piece is as accurate as we can get it. There's a lot of work that goes into these things. And I think so many members of the public just think we throw these things off and into thin air and they appear in the front page and we don't think a whole lot about them. But it just isn't the case at all.
Mm-hmm. If I may also.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Go ahead. Please. No, go ahead.
Well, Lisa, too, you asked if we're always scouring social media. I would suggest we're not scouring social media for public relations people. We're more scouring social media for real people. You know, what does a shopper say about that Hallmark experience? Or in my experience, we're always looking for farmers who are talking about something. And we use a lot of hashtag searches. And so we tend to be much more strategic about how we handle social media.
Well, and congratulations. I just wanted to say a shout-out to you for the KCUR and your show for breaking the story up in Smithville. That was
up in Maryville, right. Yeah.
Maryville, excuse me. That was picked up. So thank you. I'll enjoy the rest of the show.
Lisa, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Let's grab one more phone call here before our break. Let's go to Bill from Grandview. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Bill.
Good shows.
Thanks.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
My question, are you familiar with the Bill Moyers program from Sunday on the public television about the dollarocracy, about local news stations?
Us about it real quick.
Well, just briefly, the concept was that political dollars are affecting news reporting, and to the extent that some news hours are either being reduced to make more room for news political money, or they're expanding the news hour and incorporating the spins or the political reporting in within the news, therefore not giving a balanced approach to actually what's going on in politics. And my question is, would any of this fall into social media and or print as well? Did I make myself clear?
I'm not sure you did. Pam, are you tracking that?
Not really.
Yeah, Bill, you're saying that they're shortening the amount of time they're devoting to news to get in more political advertising?
Correct. And consequently, they are also finding some of the studies that they're actually expanding the news time, but incorporating those political news reports, those PAC reports or whatever, within those where people would actually interpret them as being part of the news.
Oh, I see.
Interesting. Well, there is a trend toward what's being called native advertising, which allows advertisers, including political candidates and campaigns, to have more access to media. And, you know, everybody's struggling to find revenue streams. And so there is a proliferation of sponsored material or content on websites and, I guess, in other news publications. There's no question that TV revenues go up when it's campaign season, and that many stations budget and rely on a lot of dollars during election season.
Yeah, I don't think, Bill, you can underestimate just how much money gets spent. And I'd be curious to know the extent to which political advertising is keeping some local TV stations afloat these days, because every other year we're talking so much money coming in to those stations. And it is just remarkable. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with our media critics. We'll continue talking about getting it wrong and what's going on. And Derek Donovan's column from last weekend about folks who declined to comment on news stories and the impact that has on news coverage. We'll also get some phone calls here from folks who are online now. Just hang on for us. We'll get to you after our break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
Here and Now is next on KCUR, and coming up, why wasn't the Philippines prepared for that typhoon? And a missionary in the Philippines describes the efforts to get aid to where it's needed. Also, fewer than expected enroll with healthcare.gov, and Chinese leaders map out a new reform agenda. A few of the topics at which we're looking on Here and Now at noon till 2 on KCUR. Funding for KCUR comes from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, celebrating 80 years of serving the Kansas City community and where thousands of alumni call home. They are UMKC proud. Information is online at umkc.edu/proud. And Dental Care 50, helping people over 50 connect with local dentists and specialists as they transition to an individual dental plan after retirement, with no restrictions on pre-existing dental conditions. More information is online at dentalcare50.com. It's 25 degrees in Midtown Kansas City at 11:40. You're listening to 89.3 FM KCUR, online at kcur.org, a service of UMKC.
Mm-hmm. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting today with our media critics, Peggy Lowe, a reporter and editor for Harvest Public Media, Derek Donovan, an ombudsman for The Star. Pam Fine is a professor of journalism over at KU. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Now, I should just remind folks, if you missed yesterday's conversation with Kansas City's retiring Planned Parenthood leader or our chat with the head of the VFW, you can find those at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, Kennedy's assassination still holds a certain mystique in our culture, especially when it comes to the famed Zapruder film. We'll look at its place in the event's history. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination here in just a few days. Well, let's continue our conversation here. Let's go back to some phone calls and go to Gretchen from Kansas City, Missouri. Gretchen, good morning. You're on the show.
Good morning.
Hi.
I am just calling with a, a complaint or about the lack of local television news, but grateful to print and radio. I had to stop watching news on television because I was screaming at my TV too often.
Uh-oh.
When at 10 o'clock at night, live breaking news from the school board and somebody standing there saying, you know, the school board met today. That's not live breaking news. That's the school board building. And I just think that the whole breaking news and live news is just a waste. You know, spend the time and resources to try to get a quote or an interview outside a press conference. So I don't understand the whole reporting from a closed down building.
Why do they do it, Pam Fine? Why would a TV reporter do that?
Because they need pictures.
They need
television,
a visual, don't they?
Is about pictures.
Yeah.
I can get a picture of the school board closed, no problem. I think it really makes it seem like they. Then maybe we are just so stupid that we would consume that as news. I don't know.
All right. Gretchen, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Moti from Overland Park. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to talk about the Benghazi issue and the fact that it was kind of a talking point on right-wing media for a long time before it was picked up by CBS.
And 60 Minutes you're talking about, right.
Yes, yeah, and there's been a 30-year effort on the part of sort of the conservative blogosphere to say that the mainstream media is liberal, and I'm wondering and I'm asking whether the panelists feel that the media outlets are bending over backwards to appeal to that section of the populace to prove that they're not liberal by putting forward more conservative viewpoints or more conservative talking points on there. News programs.
Well, you do hear that from time to time. Derek Donovan, you think that's going on out there?
You know, I think that that is a criticism being at this point so institutional that I think that mainstream journalists sort of have this knee-jerk reaction to it because they are not trained to be biased. They are trained to be, you know, as objective as they can about things. And so I think that there's maybe an additional touchiness about that they want to go out of their way to prove that, no, we're not going to not consider this just because it's coming from a talking point coming from somebody on the right. That being said, I have to confess to a little bit of bewilderment over the whole conservative mm-hmm. critique of Benghazi. Mm-hmm. It has been all over the place. It has not been consistent in what its talking points are. And it seems to me that a lot of what people are bringing up are the exact same kind of armchair quarterbacking over the September 11th, 2001 massacre that, you know, a lot of people on the left were trying to say is all George Bush's fault. I've never really understood where this Benghazi critique came from. And again, because it's been so inconsistent, I was sort of surprised to see 60 Minutes stepping into it the way that they did.
Well, I think the critique came because there was a real question about whether that embassy was more vulnerable than it needed to be. And mm-hmm. people died. And when that happens, I think there needs to be accountability for that. So I think some of the questions raised were fair. Interestingly, when we talked about impact of a story, a broadcast story, the 60 Minutes apology came after the New York Times and the Washington Post aggressively covered or revealed that Davis, the fellow who was interviewed on Benghazi, had told a different story to the FBI. And so it was the newspapers holding up the 60 Minutes story to light that really propelled the apology from 60 Minutes.
What about this notion, Pam, that 60 Minutes hasn't apologized enough? They didn't apologize in the right manner. Do you buy that?
Well, I do. Like, both in the AP story we mentioned before, the case in which the reporter was fired for not checking, and then again in 60 Minutes, we really haven't learned yet what happened. What was the reporter's thinking, or what were the actual failures? Why didn't they make those phone calls? So the criticism of 60 Minutes isn't that they didn't say they were sorry enough. It's that they didn't shine light on the reporting process effectively. And so I like that because we can all learn from that, whether you're a professor like me or a practitioner. What steps should have been taken to verify that this fellow was actually there the night of the Benghazi killings?
Mm-hmm.
I love this caller's question, Steve, because I think that this is going to be written about hopefully this week, certainly into the future, because I would love to know, as Pam is saying, the transparency behind this. Did they not call the FBI? I mean, it's clear that this guy told the FBI early on that he was actually on the beach, literally. He was at a beachside villa the night that the compound, you know, was attacked. And so why didn't they call the FBI for comment? Why didn't they call, you know, the usual suspects for comment? How could this guy get on the air and get such great treatment? Down further in some of the ombudsman's reports here, it's suggesting that CBS Corporation is publishing a book by this guy. So perhaps this was just like a nice little infomercial for the guy who ultimately was found to be a liar. And some people have suggested, too, that Laura Logan may have a conservative bias. So I find that interesting, too. She said in an speech she gave a few months ago.
She's a 60 Minutes reporter.
Yeah, Laura Logan. I'm sorry. She suggested that America should, and I'm quoting here, exact revenge and let the world know what the U.S. will not be attacked. I mean, she came out and gave an opinion after Benghazi. Mm. And then she comes up with this report. So that's fascinating to me. And like your caller, I hope there's more coverage.
Moti, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, update@kcur.org. Derek Donovan, you wrote a piece in The Star on Sunday that deals with people who declined to comment on a story. I'm wondering, what obligation does a member of the media have to find someone who will comment? Do they have to worry about it at all? How do they handle this idea when certain folks just won't talk?
One of the things that I'm constantly reminded of is there's no such thing as a subject that there's a one side and another side. You know, there's always much more than just two things. You know, life is not binary. Life is not black and white. So you could, you know, say you could take that out to absurdity. How many people do you need to talk to about any one topic? I think that the bottom line is that reporters always need to, if there seems to be one preponderance of, you know, a point of view, to try to seek out somebody who's on the other side if they can. But also to remember that ultimately anybody who talks to a journalist is volunteering themselves in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of those people are attention seekers and attention seekers in a lot of different walks of life. And what is frustrating to me, and part of the reason I wrote this column, is because I very often hear from the wallflowers, the people who, oh, no, I don't want to go on the record about this. But they do have sometimes an extremely compelling counterpoint to something that a source has said in a story. And so that is, it's a source of A, personal frustration that they can't get their word out, but also journalistically, you know, a reporter would love to talk to those folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they're not going to talk, they're not going to talk. Nobody can force them.
Yeah, I worry sometimes in my own reporting about Republicans and being able to reach certain Republican office holders. You get a sense, and I've read about this nationally, that more and more aren't really interested in talking to the mainstream media because the folks who vote for them oftentimes don't read the mainstream media and they don't need us like they used to need us. I find that to be a really increasingly unnerving kind of proposition in our business right now.
And you know that's also not just the right. You know, there's very much a parallel alternative media on the left as well,
right.
that very
right.
much goes straight to its base. And you know, it's not just politics either. I wrote about this several years ago. I've got a good friend who's a senior lawyer at one of the biggest corporations in America, and I asked him, "You read about your corporation in the news all the time. How often do they get it right?" And he said, "Well, not really all that often." And I said, "Well, what do you guys do when you find that? Do you reach out to the journalist to tell them, hey, you've got a mistake here? No, we just let it go." And, you know, any journalist would just be pulling their hair out to hear that because, again, I've never run into a journalist who didn't care if they got something wrong.
Yeah. Slightly different kind of situation. What if one side in a dispute is clearly off base? You know, like those who dispute the existence of climate change, for instance, or maybe going a little farther, the Nazis who took part in the rally over the weekend in downtown Kansas City. Should the media cover statements, you know, like the Nazis, like those who still believe that climate change is not occurring? Is there a place in our stories for information that's clearly disputed to the point of being not accurate, not worthy of merit on some level, Peggy?
I have thought about this a lot because I've covered a lot of civil rights movements and a lot of politics in my day. And, for instance, in covering a big gay rights amendment in Colorado in the early 90s, the conservative side was saying some really vile things that were not true. And yet they wouldn't say anything that I could print that, you know, to the issue. So I often thought, you know, for instance, those reporters in the 50s and 60s who were covering the civil rights movement, when did they stop calling the Klan? When do you stop calling the Klan for comment?
Yeah.
And so I think it's just something we wrestle with. On the climate change issue that you just brought up, that took a few years to, like, people are now saying we're not going to quote the deniers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Los Angeles Times just stopped printing
yes.
letters from the deniers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just – that's just sort of a process, and it's a really uncomfortable one for journalists, as you well know.
Mm-hmm. How about the Nazi thing this week? And I mean – should the media have covered that? We had all kinds of cameras down there. Why? You know?
Yeah, well, this is actually a conversation that Pam and I were having before we went on the air today.
I mean, it's a really good conversation, didn't I?
Yeah, you need to come down to the green room.
Yeah.
Just for the record, the Star devoted most of the local cover on Sunday to what ended up actually being the counter-protest from the peace activists. And the question is whether this should have been a story in the first place, because this is a perfect example of an event that was created for nothing other than to get media attention. And, you know, when people talk about that notorious church, whose name I will not mention because they're not really a church, all they do is travel the country to find places that people are likely to point cameras at them.
Mm-hmm.
They have no legitimate following. They have no social currency whatsoever. They're there to get attention.
And the media, by and large, ignores that group now.
The professional media does. Now, social media, I tell you what, there are more camera phones on the Phelps Klan out there than have ever been television or newspaper cameras.
Mm-hmm. Well, should the Star have covered the event on Saturday at all?
Well, it certainly rose to the number of participants to merit, according to the protest coverage guidelines.
Meaning over 20-25
right,
protesters,
yeah.
The Star will go out and cover something.
Exactly.
Like that.
And there were hundreds of counter-protesters there. I would say that, no, it was overcovered, in my personal opinion.
Yeah. Pam?
Yeah. I was at the Atlanta Constitution for many years, and we had the same situation with the Ku Klux Klan, which frequently got parade permits to march in small towns throughout Georgia. And eventually, we just stopped covering them. That doesn't mean you don't do a body watch. You might send a reporter out there to make sure something doesn't happen. But you don't – it's like also like a bomb scare. I mean, we have a kind of a practice where we don't report those because we don't want to help feed those kinds of activities. So my view is that the Star overplayed that story. They might have put a brief inside the paper, but I thought it was way out of proportion for the event, and that it just keeps people who have crazy notions out on the streets trying to get publicity for them.
Yeah. One other big question today. What about this issue of paying sources for interviews? The Toronto Star just did that, paying $5,000 to get a compromising video of that city's mayor smoking a crack pipe. Is that acceptable or is it not?
You know, it's got to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. In general,
what could possibly justify it?
Well, if you look at the Star's Code of Ethics, you know, it says just flatly, the Star does not pay for news. And so what that is talking about is, like, for example, you don't give somebody money to go out and bribe a city crew to do private work for you. You know, that would be paying for news. When it comes down to when you've got footage of something happening, you know, another example recently is the footage from the skydivers who got the film of the planes colliding in midair above them. You know, newspapers pay photographers for their work all the time. And to me, that's not at all paying for news coverage.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think that the Rob Ford thing, that is a very tricky, very complicated case. But I think you could make a case that this video was not created. This video was created, you know, of the mayor of the largest city in Canada. It's out there, and that you could argue the public has a right to see it.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, what are you thinking?
Oh, it makes me all very uncomfortable. You know, I don't think that you get to pay your sources for them to talk to you. I too think the Star thing is iffy. That mayor for months has said, I didn't smoke crack. You know, I wasn't ever going to do all these things. And then they got him on video. You know, I mean, that's proof. And again, that goes in the photos and videos slot where newspapers have always paid for that kind of stuff. So it's a case-by-case basis.
The mayor had also criticized the reporters from that newspaper, saying they were sensationalist and way out of line. And here the paper had a chance to prove him wrong directly.
That's absolutely right. Right.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
mean, it's just such a lurid story saying, you know, yes, I smoked crack, but I was completely drunk.
But what's the difference between paying for a video, Derek, and paying for someone just to give you an interview for a story you're doing?
Well, I think it's kind of a slippery slope. And when you're talking about saying that, for example, I want to interview the mayor of Kansas City, I'm not saying this is Sly James, I'm saying, you know, hypothetical mayor, and he says, well, okay, I'm going to charge you $100 per interview from now on. I think that you'd see most professional news organizations that are going to kind of wash their hands of that. And that would be a very dangerous precedent to set.
There's this notion that paying money could entice a source to exaggerate the story. Do you buy that, Pam?
I do. I mean, I want to go back and say that doing a little research on this topic, I saw that the New York Times paid the wire operator on the Titanic $1,000 for his story so that the Times had an exclusive. So there's a long history of the news media paying for exclusive interviews, book serializations, photos,
videos.
The Zapruder
film, we're going to talk about it tomorrow on the show. Life magazine paid a lot of money for that, and
right.
A lot of organizations were willing to pay a lot of money for that film.
Yeah, I think the key is whether it would compromise the integrity of the news reporting or distort the reporting in some way. So I think Derek's right. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
Well, that music means we are out of time. I want to thank you all for your time today, our media critics again, Peggy Lowe, Derek Donovan, and Pam Fine. Thanks so much.
Glad
to have
thank
you all
you,
here.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
You can find more information about all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the show, an author joins us to break down the historic footage of JFK's assassination known as the Zapruder film. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.